Is sugar really the dietary Darth Vader?
Are we really lowering readmission rates to the hospital?
What are the benefits of fish oil during pregnancy?
And what do you know about healthcare spending in the United States?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 30th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we're going to start with our oldest study first. We're going to turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. This was a review of the literature relative to sugar consumption and whether it's really, as I said, the dietary Darth Vader that we're all framing it up to be. This study is a little bit older, but we did our fun one last week, so that's why we're using it.
Since this is our last recording of the year, summarizing these important studies is important. And I'm glad you picked this particular one because I was actually unaware of the results. There's assumed to be a relationship between sugar and health, and there are several different public health guidelines related to sugar. And interesting enough, they don't always agree. So what these authors intended to do was to systematically review the guidelines on sugar intake and to assess the consistency of the recommendations, look at the methodology behind it and the quality of the guidelines, and also the evidence quality as well. They identified 9 different guidelines, and they offered 12 recommendations regarding sugar intake. And here's what they found. The guidelines actually scored pretty poorly in several areas. First of all, what was the rigor of how they were developed? Second, their applicability. And third, was their editorial independence. Furthermore, they looked at the quality of the evidence, and they thought the evidence was actually low to very low in terms of supporting the guidelines. So in essence, they concluded that these guidelines on dietary sugar don't actually meet criteria for trustworthy recommendations, and they're based on low quality evidence.
Okay, so gosh, it sounds like we don't have Darth Vader in the cage yet. But does that suggest to you that we need to go back and do some more really rigorous study in order to discern what exactly is the impact of sugar? And I think there's some of that going on right now.
Well, it does mean that we need to tighten up the guidelines. Now, interestingly enough, all the guidelines point to the same thing. They all point to reducing sugar intake. And oftentimes, they base their recommendations upon sugar-sweetened beverages and expand that to sugar overall. So you're right. I think there's a lot of misperceptions, and we need to do a lot more work in terms of tightening things up.
I guess I would still devolve, though, to the standpoint that we know that additional sugar, we've got this huge national and international problem with obesity, certainly with type 2 diabetes, and there is a relationship there. So I guess while we're waiting for really good evidence to be nailed down, I think I would still say it's good to limit sugar.
You would do that if it's replacing what are called nutrient-dense foods, or if there's caloric excess, yes. But if someone that doesn't have caloric excess and is eating a healthy diet, is reducing sugars actually help? That's what we don't know.
More on that, undoubtedly. Let's turn from here then to something else that's a dietary supplement that has been in the news all over the place for many years. We even reported once a study on its utility in people who had had an MI in terms of preventing a second one. This is a look at fish oil supplementation in pregnant women and whether that helps reduce wheezing in their offspring. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So Elizabeth, this came out of left field as far as I was concerned. We've reported about the use of fish oils in people with heart disease, and they haven't been quite as helpful as we'd like for them to be. But this issue of using fish oil in pregnant women to prevent children from having wheezing and asthma, this was kind of unusual. We know that the incidence of asthma and wheezing has more than doubled in westernized countries over the most recent decades, and that's mostly in children, by the way. And based upon observational studies, it looked like asthma or the wheezing may be related to diet, specifically the increase in omega-6 fatty acids and the decrease in omega-3 fatty acids. The omega-3 fatty acids are the fish oils. And why would that be? It looks like the change in omega-6 to omega-3 ratio increases or potentially increases the rate of inflammation. And we know this is associated with asthma and wheezing. So how do you test this? Well, they took over 700 pregnant women, and in the last trimester of pregnancy, gave half of them olive oil, and the other half they gave omega-3 fatty acids. And neither the women nor the investigators knew which they were receiving. And they followed the kids for up to 5 years. And what they discovered is the women who received the omega-3 fatty acids, the fish oils, in the last trimester of pregnancy, their children had a 30% reduction in the risk of persistent asthma and wheezing. To show biologic plausibility, this outcome was most marked in women that had the lowest levels of omega-3 fatty acids, either in their bloodstream or in their dietary intake. So it seems like there's really something behind this.
Very, very interesting. Well, we've known for some time, of course, that these fats are important in this lung development part. And so who knows what exactly the mechanism is, but it sounds like, hey, there's no downside to doing it, so why not do it? And maybe it's going to have a good impact.
And you're right, Elizabeth, there was no safety issues at all. It's more than you'd ever receive in a diet. It's about 8 to 10 times more than you'd receive just by eating fish. Maybe the more inexpensive thing is just to give it to all women who are in the third trimester of pregnancy.
Instead of those evil vitamins, which are really big and hard to swallow, I would just offer my opinion. Let's turn from here then back to animals. Something that's more of a global issue. Hey, how do we reduce readmissions? When we try to reduce the number of people who come back to the hospital, does that really help?
And the thought behind this is not that we don't want sick or ill people to be in the hospital, but oftentimes we can discharge them before they're ready and they get readmitted, or we don't do proper follow-up, or they don't receive the right medications. There are a number of different reasons why people get readmitted within 30 days of their hospitalization. As a function of the Affordable Care Act, they also created the Medicare Hospital Readmission Reduction Program. So the hospitals that have the highest rate of readmission, they actually, at the end of the year, receive a penalty. They have to pay money back to the federal government. How effective is that? You'd also like the lowest performing hospitals to get on the bandwagon. So the next question is, did it lower the rate of readmissions, and was it most beneficial in the hospitals that were the lower performers? So they looked at over 15 million Medicare patients who were discharged alive from 2000 to 2013. And what they discovered was this program did decrease hospital readmissions across the United States. Furthermore, the readmissions were most improved in the hospitals that were the lowest performers.
So my concern really is, okay, so we don't bring them back to the hospital, but do these folks die more often if we compare that to another group of people who don't come back to the hospital?
That wasn't examined in this study. So long-term survival or mortality wasn't examined, only hospital readmissions.
As a person who's responsible for a hospital and for exactly these kinds of outcomes, what's your interpretation?
I actually was skeptical when it first came out, but I've actually jumped on the bandwagon, because when the hospital realizes there's going to be a financial penalty associated with readmission, then they also do their best to prevent readmissions. That's making sure that people are discharged healthier, they're on the right medications to make sure they have adequate follow-up, and to address any medical concerns as an outpatient.
Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This was a really gigantic analysis of healthcare spending in the U.S.
As you said, Elizabeth, this is one of those ginormous studies, the magnitude of which we very rarely see. Healthcare spending in the United States is greater than in any country in the world. In fact, if you just look at our healthcare spending, which reached $2.9 trillion in 2014, and accounts for more than 17% of the U.S. economy. If it was just an economy by itself, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. What these investigators did was to give us an estimate of the U.S. spending on personal health care and public health according to different conditions, according to different ages and sex groups and different types of care. They looked at over 183 sources of data, and here's what they discovered. Over the course of the last 17 years, we've spent $30 trillion of personal health care spending. That's not federal government, that's personal health care spending. Number one, diabetes. Number two, heart disease. The third, low back pain and neck pain, $88 billion. The personal health care spending increased for 143 of the 155 conditions over the last 17 years. This gives us some idea of where we're spending our health dollars to allow us to address these particular conditions.
Was there any metric that compared this to inflation?
It did not compare it to overall inflation, but as you know, that the cost of health care has eclipsed overall inflation over the last 15 years.
Well, I don't know what to say about any of this, except for there is no doubt it's going to be used in this recrafting of our entire healthcare industry with this incoming administration.
And I agree with you. I think the implications for this are important with regard to our efforts to control U.S. health care spending. Interestingly, of the 14 conditions associated with the highest health care spending, 10 are due to chronic diseases that we have some control over with respect to our lifestyle and our personal choices.
That's good news, I think. I like that idea that we can all have an impact on this. On that note, I am going to talk about the fish oil study this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, wishing you a happy and healthy new year. Y'all live well.